I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, digging up the twined, dark, disputatious roots of modern sensibilities with Kevin Birmingham. He's written a dazzling epic around the battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, the most dangerous book, he calls it. And behind the book and the battle, Kevin Birmingham has unveiled the author, Joyce, as I've never understood him before, in deeper eye pain and maybe syphilitic blindness than we knew, but also more single-minded and self-aware, more determined to stand by every clean and dirty syllable of his tricky masterpiece. And then there's all that comes in the wake of the most original, most influential book of the 20th century. It sells about 100,000 copies a year now, ever in the global bestseller zone, and not for what we as kids used to call the good parts. And so Eve Sorum of UMass Boston will join the conversation to make the connections with those other modernists who weren't all crazy about Ulysses, Ezra Pound, who was, but Virginia Woolf, who declined to publish it, and the giant English novelist of World War I, Ford Madox Ford. Also Howard Island of MIT, biographer of Walter Benjamin, will make the connection with everything else we think of as modern and modernist, including Nietzsche, Proust, Freud, and Einstein. Kevin Birmingham, you're up first. Thank you for this book. It's a thrill to read. And I don't always say that. You've given us James Joyce as I didn't know him, insanely clever, we did know, but vulnerable, resolute, strange, adorable, and somehow all of a piece. I wish you'd just count the ways, for starters, in which James Joyce embodies everything we call modern.
Well, the first thing is that Joyce was a resolute individualist. And this individualism was a form of contrarianism in those early years of the 20th century. And for Joyce, he identified himself actually as an anarchist, an individualist anarchist,
yep.
In 1907, as early as 1907. And for him to be an anarchist was to be a philosophical anarchist. It wasn't to be a bomb thrower. It wasn't to be violent. In fact, he hated violence. But to be an anarchist for him meant to be opposed to the sort of abstractions that he thought were running the world, that God was an abstraction and the church used that abstraction for power.
Mm.
Divine right or legitimacy, those were abstractions and the state was using that for its power over individuals. And so instead of looking at the world from the top down, from abstractions that sort of rule the world, Joyce was interested in seeing the world from the bottom up, from tiny things, from what we call epiphanies, right? The soul of the commonest object could yield a crucial insight for all of us. And when you read a book like Ulysses, this is a book that pays attention to the day-to-day things, the things that we normally overlook. And so to be a modernist for Joyce, one of the things was to work from the bottom up, to not think about how we can organize the world from abstractions and from the top down.
I want to interrupt you just to say, speak about place as sort of a badge of this book and of modernism. Place, first in the sense that, in a way, all roads lead to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, in the sense of his continuing isolation before he got to Paris and even afterward, but also just this sense of a book as a walk around a city. And he felt that it could have been, not that it could have been any city necessarily, but that Dublin, he could locate any human drama in those streets of Dublin that he knew like the back of his hand.
He actually was proud to say that if Dublin were wiped off the map, you could reconstruct all of the streets through his works. And that's how dedicated he was to Dublin. Now, it's not surprising that a person would be dedicated to the city in which he or she grew up. For Joyce, what was surprising is that he was still imagining Dublin when he was not in Dublin. He was writing Ulysses in Trieste, which at the time was part of the Austrian Empire. He moved to Zurich during the war and later was in Paris. So he was recalling Dublin in his memory, and Dubliners would come to Joyce in Paris to visit them, and he had this parlor game that he would play where he would name all of the storefronts that were along O'Connell Street, what is now O'Connell Street in the center of Dublin. And when someone said, oh, well, at this point, that storefront has now changed, it was disturbing because it was frozen for him in 1904. And when he left Dublin, he never lived in Dublin again after 1904. So in a way, there was a certain love that he had for that city. That was the love of someone who is remembering it.
What's the modern piece of that urbanity?
What do you mean? Like what's...
Well, I mean, it recurs in Mrs. Dalloway. It recurs in Teju Cole's marvelous novel, Open City, of just a couple of years ago, about sort of seeing through a city, seeing it almost x-raying it, seeing it archaeologically, seeing it in many periods and histories and et cetera, but bringing a city alive.
I think there are a lot of things that I think make cities special to modernism and important to modernism. One is that they're gathering spots for multiple different types of people. And so when you read a poem like The Wasteland, for example, it's a pastiche of a bunch of different voices. And that's a crucial aspect to literary modernism. Another thing for Joyce in particular is chance encounters, walking down the street and happening to run into someone. And the city was perfect for chance encounters, not just Dublin, but also particularly in Paris, and the cafe culture of Paris fostered these chance encounters where you might just happen to see someone in a cafe and you can sit down and have a chat and then leave and then walk down the street and there's another cafe and you see someone else. And this sort of gathering of, you know, the empire, as we're also calling it, in one spot is crucial to a form of cosmopolitanism that was central to modernism.
So many other little badges of the time, including feminism, which runs through your book and also his head. But I'm also thinking of the conception of an artist, the conception of the audience. I love the line, which I hadn't ever heard before, that he would have settled for one person reading his book a million times. That's just as fine as having a million people read it once. What is that telling you?
Well, and this, in a way, goes is a little bit of a point that's contrary to the city aspect and the wideness of the city, which is that modernists were normally fairly happy to speak to small audiences. And Joyce knew that Ulysses was not going to be reaching a wide audience. What he wanted, and what Ezra Pound wanted, for example, when he was interested in the little magazines, was an intensely dedicated audience that was small. When Ezra Pound started to be involved with the Little Review, which serialized Ulysses in New York from 1918 to 1921, it had 3,000 subscribers. That's a small number of subscribers, but for him it was perfect. It was the perfect number because he was trying to foster an avant-garde, a small sliver of society that can talk to itself, that can lead the sheep onward, as he put it. He was unabashedly an elitist as well. But Joyce's version of that Poundian idea is a little bit different. I think that he wanted intimacy with readers. And I think that he thought of readers, as I say, at one point.
That's another modern piece from that moment. You, I think it's your line that magazines were the blogosphere of modernism.
Yes.
That's the way it worked.
They're talking to one another. There are ads for one modernist magazine and another modernist magazine. You knew what was happening in the other modernist magazines. They were talking to one another. They were sometimes at odds with one another. One of the things about modernism is that it was very fractious, right? So the futurists didn't necessarily like the surrealists. The surrealists didn't care about the imagistes. These were all people who were doing their own thing in one sector of the culture and were speaking to each other a little bit, but didn't necessarily get along. And
go ahead.
I think what changed, we think of 1922 as sort of the year for modernism. What changed is the publication both of Ulysses and The Wasteland in 1922. But what happened, I think, was that suddenly there was the arrival of a masterpiece. And now suddenly all these little bands of rebels have a standard bearer to look at. And once you have a masterpiece for a movement, that movement changes. And it's not a coincidence that not long after the publication of Ulysses, the word modernism as a word, it starts to be used, or at least the way we're using it now in terms of the arts, is that you start to name it and suddenly it's official.
Kevin Birmingham, come back to the book itself, 1922, infamous even before then, for its bodiness, but also for its bodiness, its sort of carnality, its physical thing. He said, think of it as an epic of the human body. Explain that as a sort of modern insistence that we're going to deal with things. Somebody said to him, well, it's in the mind too. And he said, no, there's no separating them. The physical insistence of this book.
What about the thoughts of the characters? And then Joyce would say, well, if they didn't have bodies, they wouldn't have thoughts. And part of the idea is that Joyce wanted to include everything. You know, to have an epic of modernity was to not gloss over any details of human life. So you talk about the scrotum-tightening sea, or snot-green sea, or, you know, going to the bathroom and masturbating and having sex. And all these things are part of life, but they were not present in literature. And it was as if there was this massive blind spot. And Joyce wanted to fill in all of those blind spots. And there was a certain ugliness to it that he didn't shy away from. And it's another element of modernism, I think, that people were more likely to try to experiment with the aesthetics of ugliness, right?
Was that a modern thing, or was that a Joyce thing that he inflicted on modernism?
I think a lot of people are interested in ugliness or violence, for example. You know, you just you think of the futurists who are celebrating violence really to a dangerous degree. They're thinking of, you know, explosions like orchids going off. And but Joyce, it is true that Joyce paid attention to the body in ways that, you know, someone like Virginia Woolf wouldn't dare to do, or other prominent modernists that we still remember today. But he was captivated by the body. He was, in a way, trapped by his own body. He was in pain. He was sick for a while, and that made a difference.
Hold it there. We're coming back. We're talking about James Joyce's Ulysses, the book that seeded a century and a sensibility called modernism. Coming up, the present dayness of those 20th century masterworks. Think Virginia Woolf, Ford Madox Ford, Picasso, Einstein too. But before we let Joyce go, here is the sound of the singer, the performer, entertainer, lyrical prose man reading from his last work, Finnegan's Wake.
Well, you know, don't you, Kenneth, or haven't I told you, every telling has a tailing, and that's the he and the she of it. Look, look, the dusk is growing. My branches lofty are taking root, and my cold chair's gone ashly. Feel-o, feel-o.
This is The Modern Moment on Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. Kevin Birmingham has reintroduced us to the Irish exile and rebel genius James Joyce in his novel Ulysses that cleared the path for modernism. Eve Sorum teaches the literature of the movement at UMass Boston. Howard Island covers the rest of it, including the science and the theory at MIT. Here is one musical taste of it all, a nocturne for the piano written by Erik Satie in Paris in 1919. Sorum, remind us of the setting here, post-World War I. The world is gasping more in despair, you'd think, more in despair than in discovery after the mechanized war that killed millions, in a sense, changed everything. Straighten our heads out for 1922.
Well, so I think that there are a number of elements to think about to kind of get us set up for how we could have a world that produces something like Ulysses, something like these other masterpieces that really emerge from the ashes. It really was a sense of emerging from ashes, because World War I was seen and felt and experienced as this cataclysmic event by many of these writers, whether they were at the front, writers like Ford Madox Ford, who was at the front and ended up writing this amazing tetralogy, Parade's End, or writers like Woolf, who was at home in England and, in fact, was ill during much of the war. But this idea of having a kind of definitive break with the past. I think that this is something that is not simply terrifying because it implies a chasm, but in fact rejuvenating. This is what Wolf talked about in her essay, Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Brown, which was also published as Character and Fiction, where she talks about how the Edwardians, the kind of previous generation of writers, were working with different material and were writing about things that were no longer relevant. Their idea of what defined character was no longer relevant in this this modern
or world. Narrative, for example,
or narrative. And she was defining character. She was focusing on character in this and on the ways in which narrative, in fact, needed to be in service of finding a character. And that meant that a narrative wouldn't necessarily be chronological. We wouldn't necessarily have the kind of Bildungsroman that we had in the 19th century.
David Copperfield.
Mm-hmm, exactly. We don't begin at the beginning, as he does
I
there.
Am born, yes.
Right. And instead, we're going to have these narratives, and she talks about this in another essay, Modern Fiction, how life is not a series of gig lamps symmetrically arranged, but a luminous halo, a semi-transparent envelope surrounding us from the beginning of consciousness to the end, and that the novelist has to somehow try to find that light within that luminous halo. So the war provided a kind of break in both traumatic socially and personally, certainly physically, for many writers, but also in some ways I think we can see some of the opportunity. She talks about the kind of crashing and breaking that has to occur. She's bringing up Joyce in her essay, Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Brown, as one of the new writers, Joyce and Forrester, Eliot. And
Ford Madoc Ford, I read the whole thing 20 years ago.
Yes.
And remember, what I remember is the name Christopher Titchens and the phrase, a sort of cliche, shell shock.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't
mm-hmm.
a cliche then. It was a reality.
Yes.
Take it apart.
So Ford is, I think I would almost pose the claim that perhaps we could see Parade's End as a kind of other bookend of the great modernist masterpiece like Ulysses, but very much Parade's End, which is four novels, which is why most people don't read it because it's very long, and is experimental, but is very much about World War One, about the experiences in World War One of the different characters, specifically Christopher Titchens, the main character, and who suffers from shell shock. And shell shock, I think, becomes the most interesting and powerful metaphor for what it means to try to create in this post-war world, because it involves creating a story that is based on loss of memory, loss of health. You're circling around some kind of empty center. And this is actually a line that Lily Briscoe in To the Lighthouse, in Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, near the end of it, as she's reflecting on the loss of Mrs. Ramsey, this central character whom she has loved, talks about the kind of arabesques that you create around this empty center of the lost person. And I think we can think about the mental losses, those mental emptinesses, the social ones, the individual ones, and how those created this kind of space for creation, for an attempt to build something new, but not something that then could ever be left behind or forgotten. The loss is still there.
Interesting. Howard Island, biographer of that great mystery man, Walter Benjamin, also known as Walter Benjamin, walk us through it, especially the essential ideas that unified the period. Can you say what the big ones are?
Well, T.S. Eliot has an essay about about Ulysses in which he refers to to the mythical method of the novel. And he talks about Joyce's appropriation of the Odyssey, Joyce's of Homer's Odyssey, and talks about the way in which these mythical patterns are still in some sense viable for modern experience and modern art. Now, of course, one of the things we mean, first of all, by the term modern is an opposition to the ancient. And so we're talking about a world in which the gods are not present anymore. In the ancient world, the gods are swarming in every rock, in every tree, in every hill. The world is somehow enchanted, is sacred. From Copernicus onward in the 16th century, we now have a world in which it's not swarming with gods, but it's a world of matter and energy, and therefore can be dissected by science. It's not sacred anymore. And so there is this break with the world of myth and the world of a kind of center. In the ancient world, the earth, of course, is seen as the center of our experience. Copernicus is saying, no, it's not the center. There may not be a center. We are in motion. There is no static foundation. This was such a radical idea, since everyone really, not just Ptolemy and the Ptolemaic theory of the geocentric universe that began in Alexandrian times, but pagan man before this, pagan humanity before this, naturally assumed that the Earth was at the center, because that's what common sense tells us.
Who's your great modern exponent of the alternative idea, the alternative mystery?
Well,
or anxiety.
This idea was so radical and it was so unsettling that it took a long time to sort of settle in. In the middle of the 17th century, about 100 years after Copernicus first published this idea, Pascal says, "When I look up into the sky, I don't any longer know what direction I'm looking, whether up or down or sideways, and I'm filled with a kind of dizziness." And this sense of vertigo, in a way, is characteristic of the modern experience, this decentering, this sense of groundlessness. So there is this radical break with the ancient world. And at the same time, there is a sense of somehow being connected to that world still. And I think it's actually in the artists who arrive from the 17th century on, it's in the artists that we see an attempt to recapture the ancient in some sense, but in a way that would still be in accord with modern ideas.
I'm wondering, where does an artist like Joyce go to find a hero in that setting?
He goes to
Dedalus.
Archaic world. He goes to Homer.
Yes, but also to a kind of himself, a version of himself, Stephen Dedalus in the novels, but also to Leopold Bloom. I mean, how do you construct a hero in that setting?
This is not Odysseus. This is not a man who achieves things by the strength of his right arm and who, even in his 50s, can out-wrestle a young man. Nevertheless, this is a man who learns wherever he goes. That's one of the first things Homer says about Odysseus. He always learned in all of his wanderings. Leopold Bloom always has his eyes open. He's always learning. Mm. Leopold Bloom doesn't have the physical courage of Odysseus, but he has a kind of moral courage. Mm. In the chapter Hades, you know, he can look at that rat crawling into the grave of his friend and actually imagine to himself what it feels like and what it tastes like for a rat to be munching on corpse meat, I think.
There's a Jewish piece here, and it's significant in the book. I mean, Leopold Bloom, one of the two protagonists, is a wanderer. He's a stateless exile. He's a peripheral figure in Dublin. He's Joyce's way of seeing himself in that world, too, no?
A middle-aged married man with all kinds of unhappinesses in his life. But who in some sense is Odysseus. He leaves the house in the morning, he wanders through the day, and he returns at the end. Odysseus leaves his home, wanders for 19 years, 17 years, and then returns. There's this structure, this rhythm of departure, initiation, and return. This encountering of monsters and witches and these descents into various kinds of underworlds. Somehow the story of the Odyssey is being retold. Somehow the human experience, for all of the tremendous changes that have occurred in our world, somehow that human body and its experience of space and time is still there. There's a strange kind of continuity with the ancient, it seems to me. And that, I think, is what Eliot meant by the mythical method, and that itself also informs his poem, The Wasteland. Here's modern London, and yet what he finds in modern London, in all of this polyphony, this ventriloquy of voices, this montage of disconnected experiences, is the old Tiresias, is somehow the humanity seeking to be reborn out of its own ashes. Mm-hmm. There is somehow this structure of death and resurrection is still at work. The poem.
Is this your Ulysses, Kevin?
It's part of it.
I mean
there's
your
not,
book?
There's not. There are so many different versions of Ulysses. I do think that the T.S. Eliot on Ulysses is still one of the best things anyone has ever written about.
A book
Ulysses.
We cannot escape.
A book and to which we are all indebted and from which we cannot escape. He thought it destroyed all the 19th century. He thought it ended the novel for good. And, you know, he was juxtaposing the mythological method with the narrative method. And what he was looking at is saying, hey, wait a second, this is a novel where narratives don't exist the way they normally should. We string existence out into cause and effect sequences. This is how we normally make sense of the world. Joyce was scrapping all of that. And that's what was so disturbing to people who were reading Ulysses, is that people were looking at it. There's a poet named Alfred Noyes who addressed the Royal Society of Literature in 1922, and it was in October, and he began with all of the invective that you expect, that it's a filthy book, it's dirty, it's obscene. But what bothered him most wasn't that it was dirty. What bothered him was that he thought it was wiping away all standards, all codes, all foundations for reality. And the reason why it was doing that is because this idea of this narrative method that guides us in our day-to-day experience, right? It's how we make sense. That's how scientists make sense of things. They compare controls and variables. It's how little kids learn that if you touch a hot stove, you're going to get burned. Joyce seemed to be pulling away from that. And what was left after the narrative method was the mythological method. And it was Ezra Pound's way of saying, make it new, to take this massive storehouse of culture that we have and to make it new again. And that's what modernism was about. It wasn't entirely about scrapping everything that was old, but it was about remaking it so radically that we don't recognize it anymore. And when T.S. Eliot said that it had destroyed all the 19th century, for him, that was a good thing. If you're a modernist, it was great to destroy the 19th
century. Keep going, if you will, on the obscenity of it and what the obscenity means. There were the words that you couldn't use, words that the Comstock generation in theory thought could just destroy your life. If you saw a four-letter word, you know, in a vulnerable moment in your childhood, it could blow your brains out. And, you know, 50 years later, there's this whole spookiness about the body. What's going on there at a level beyond the prurience or not?
I mean, one of the things that I try to do in my book is to actually make sense of what the censors were thinking.
Yeah.
And I actually think of Anthony Comstock. So Anthony Comstock the Comstock laws are named after him. He was the primary enforcer of these laws. These were obscenity laws that were written in 1872 and 1873.
Dirty words could kill you.
Dirty words, he thought, he was transfixed by the power of words. And in a way, he was the doppelganger for Joyce. They were both captivated by the power of words. But for Comstock, this power was terrifying. And for Joyce, this power was liberating and something he wanted to pursue. But for Comstock, to have heard a dirty story, to have read about someone doing something bad, or to receive a libidinous letter from a woman, was to be haunted forever by that, to be always tempted into sin. You could burn the letter, you could walk away. Years later, the words could come flooding back to you, and it was as if you were always in the thrall of words. And that terror of words and the technology of words is something that carries on into the world of Joyce and something that he loves to use.
Can you generalize about that as a symptom of modernism? I mean, there's so many funny instances. I've got to quote your line, or Joyce's line, that high modernism emerged from the low regions of the body and the mind. And then this is also that wonderful exchange, the lady who came up to Joyce and said, "May I kiss the hand that wrote Ulysses?" He said, "No, it did other things too." What are we talking about, Eve?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you were both speaking, I was really thinking about how this exploration of the kind of netherworld we can think of in all sorts of ways. I mean, it's this return to a potential underworld if we're thinking about myth, but or the kind of netherworld of the physical and the whether banal or obscene, but also within the mind. And I think that this is where we see someone like Wolf really wanting to do the same sort of thing as Joyce in many ways. She talks about how she wants to expose this the kind of incredible complexity and diversity of the experiences of the individual, and those impressions are what she tries to rein in.
We're talking about the modern moment, James Joyce's Ulysses, but I want to talk about this appetite I think a lot of us feel for a rehumanizing fresh start in 2014, this appetite for a global aesthetic with some of the clean, sweet boldness of those first moderns 100 years ago. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source on the modernist outbreak of a century ago. The music here is Igor Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale from 1918, a tragic dance with the devil. We're talking about modernism, cued by the first publication, serially, of James Joyce's Ulysses in 1922, on the occasion of Kevin Birmingham's incredibly wonderful book about it called The Most Dangerous Book. I want us to get to the question of not only when it ended, but could it happen again, and isn't a new modernism maybe overdue? Our guests here, Howard Island of MIT, Eve Sorum of UMass Boston, and the very man, Kevin Birmingham, who got the conversation started around the book that got it started. You were saying, Kevin, pick up where you were.
With Virginia Woolf?
I think it was.
Yeah, well, we were talking earlier about Virginia Woolf's reaction to Ulysses, and it was, I think, emblematic of the way a lot of people reacted to Ulysses. When they first read it, they didn't like it. And Ulysses had a strange way of slowly seeping into your bloodstream. And she was approached to serialize the first portions of Ulysses.
She is Hogarth Press.
Hogarth Press, and she declined. And T.S. Eliot came along, and she was friends with T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot kept raving about Ulysses over and over again. You have to read this book. It's the best book. It's better. It's as good as War and Peace. And she thought, that's absurd. She's writing in her diary, I can't believe Tom, as she called him, is comparing it to Tolstoy. But finally, she said, all right, I'm going to read it. And she started to read it, and she still didn't particularly like it. But as time went on, she did start to change her mind about Ulysses. But she wasn't the first one to do that. W.B. Yeats had the same reaction. At first, he thought it was madness, and then he began to like it. So people had complex reactions to Ulysses. It was a difficult book to take in all at once, if you did decide to read it all at once. And I think he's still, even today, honestly, you know, when I read it, every time I read it, there's a sort of love-hate relationship that I have with it, that I feel as if I feel frustrated at times, but there are moments of clarity and beauty. And it's a novel that you don't read. It's not written for your pleasure. It doesn't cater you. It doesn't serve you. And that's how authors normally write books. They don't write books so that you're confused. They don't write books that are going to make you turn away from it. They're trying to draw you in. And
can I just say, though, I'm finding, again, that it's a book to be read out loud by two or maybe three people. I also find it's very funny. It's unbelievably clever. There's a challenge to sort of how many how many puns are you going to miss? How many word games are you going to miss? Or how many can you catch? There's also this suspicion that you encourage, Kevin, that maybe the thing is a lot more innocent than we make it out to be in this endless conversation. It started with a children's book in his own life.
Right.
Of the, you know, the warrior, the sailor who...
Yeah, The Adventures of Ulysses.
Yeah, yeah.
11, yeah.
Yeah, and it also is incredibly playful with a sort of Mozartian energy in prose. Yeah. I think that comes out in reading it aloud, and you can't quite get it solo. What do we think? But you can't get it just by yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would think, I think that, so... Just to return to Wolf's reaction, I mean, so one of her reactions to Joyce was that the problem that she found with him was that, as she termed it, the egotistical I intruded and limited. And I think that what she meant was that there was too much a sense of wanting to control, of wanting to, that she got at least. And again, she wasn't necessarily the best reader of this book, especially in the beginning, probably in part because she felt this kind of competitive urge. T.S. Eliot, Eliot was one of her good friends. And the fact that he was saying to her, this is the next War and Peace, there was a certain sense of, wait, but what about my work?
Wolf and Joyce were born 2 weeks apart. This is something that she actually noted when he died. My goodness, he was born a fortnight after me. And then soon after that, she was dead. And it was, so she could, you could see there was, I think this is exactly right. There is a competitiveness to modernism. And I think that's part of what made it work, is that you weren't necessarily friends with the people that were in a way your, I don't want to say allies, but they're sort of your companions in a loose way, right?
Two things we haven't reached yet at all. One, the politics of this book and of the movement. Did it have a politics? But I also want to know, Howard, maybe you're the answer. How did it come to an end? Was it World War II?
How did modernism come to an end?
Yeah.
I mean, modernism, it seems to me, high modernism, as we're calling it, expands from maybe 1900 to 1940. Something changes after World War II. For one thing, most of the artists of that epoch are dead. The mood of the world has changed. One of the things about Wolfe's take on Ulysses, though, she talks about recording the atoms as they fall in the order in which they fall in this famous essay of modern fiction. This is a challenge to realism, to a new kind of heightened, or you might say avant-garde realism. If you try to record the movement of consciousness as it actually happens, what happens to human identity? What happens to what we traditionally think of as character in the great tradition of mimesis, of representation of human character in the West from Homer onward? And so Ulysses has this, introduces or at least really puts to work for the first time this method of the interior monologue, in which you listen to consciousness as it kind of moves in all of its different directions and all of its scatteredness. And where is the person in all of this as consciousness somehow moves with the movements of the time and space that it's in? Where is the boundaries, the traditional boundaries of the human person?
Different question for all of you. Where does this movement go in the United States? Ernest Hemingway is there in Sylvia Beach's bookshop. He doubtless met, he knew Ezra Pound. He
knew Joyce, drank with Joyce.
Yeah.
they were drinking buddies, and I mean it's funny to think of it, but it's true. And he was a big admirer of Joyce, especially Dubliners. He walked into Shakespeare and Company. It appears, we can't prove it, but it appears that he bought a copy of Dubliners when he first met Sylvia Beach at Shakespeare and Company. And he was arriving in Paris right around the time when Ulysses was being published. So when he was going to Shakespeare and Company, he was watching them ship off the books to the United States, to England, to everywhere else where people were ordering books. So he was plunged right into the middle of this mass, wonderful experience in Paris.
Scott Fitzgerald, too. He was an early big fan of the book, right?
Faulkner.
But Mm-hmm. Yes, from a distance, never met the man, right? But where it doesn't take root in American literature exactly. I mean, I want to let me just throw out the line, and you can
Despasos a little bit, but it's still in Faulkner to some degree. It is strange that the avant-garde doesn't really exist in the United States the same way that it did in the UK and in Paris. I think for the United States, the censorship story of Ulysses, I think, is the Americanization story of Ulysses. I think what happened with the censorship story is that we had this underground book that people were buying of, you know, you had to buy it surreptitiously, you had to sneak it into the country. If you owned a copy of Ulysses before 1933, it was a statement that you cared about free expression. To have Ulysses legalized in 1933 by Judge Woolsey, think about it, that was just a few months earlier, there were Nazi book burnings. And it was suddenly Ulysses was transformed from an avant-garde experiment to a civic virtue. And that's the sort of Ulysses that took hold in the United States. It was that it stood for free expression and that we lived in a country that wouldn't burn books, that would tolerate free expression and that would tolerate the truth.
That's one Americanization. Shoot me down, though, if you like. But to me, the vessel of this movement in the United States is jazz. Charlie Parker is the kind of James Joyce of his time. Duke Ellington writes a manifesto in the early 30s. It's almost word for word, you know, I will forge on the smithy of my soul the uncreated consciousness of my race. Duke Ellington is taking on himself an ambition to tell the history of colored people in this country. It is an adversary role, but it's also a triumphal role. And it also has beauty at the end. And an incredible, expansion of the possibilities.
I would mention also modern dance. You know, in the 1920s, Martha Graham is emerging out of Isadora Duncan, and in a certain way, Nijinsky. I think 1929, she performs in the Sacre du Printemps in New York. And invents a new kind of idiom for dance based on movement, based on the body, once again, the body's possibilities and its articulation of limbs and so on. Film as well. You know, there is a lively avant-garde movement in American film in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So maybe not so much literarily, but in these other forms, I think you do. And jazz is the great contribution here. Parker is really in the early 40s and coming, into his own in after World War II. And Charlie Parker and then
There's so many versions. Coltrane, Sonny Rollins alive Eric and Dolphin. Thriving to this day. But I want to come to the payoff question, and that is that 100 years later, Joyce and the book Ulysses read, to me, very like a very European reaction against the cultures of empire, the Victorian age, its evasions, its repressions. Who is it we're waiting for to show us in that cracked mirror our own time, including, the American century in a kind of global retrospective, putting that whole story in context? And I think it's the American orthodoxy that's in the dark now.
And what form would that take?
Exactly.
Yeah. I wish I had the answer of who it was exactly that
we were
waiting for. But two thoughts. First of all, I do feel like there has been an American avant-garde, maybe not during that period in literarily in terms of the poetry that was going on in New York City and people like William Carlos Williams and Marianne Moore and these writers who were really forging a new kind of very American-focused poetry that was in some ways consciously saying we're not on the other side. But then this question of, well, where does it go and where do we go? I personally think we actually need to return to some of these books and to some of these ideas because they still make us uneasy. And I think still need to...
Of course, I want to read them forever, but I'm also looking for a spokesman specifically in a global age mm-hmm. that's in deep trouble in the environment, in poverty, in inequality. And the American empire, you know, can be seen as...
Yeah. One of the things that's striking when you look back on the modernists is how deeply they believed in art, right? And I think that's one of the things that you need in the 21st century. It's hard to find people who will say, you know what, if I write a novel, that can actually change things. I can liberate myself. I can liberate my fellow readers through a novel. But Joyce believed that. Mm-hmm. Ezra Pound believed that the reason why World War I started was mm-hmm. because of bad poetry and prose and fiction, and that if the Germans and the British and the Americans were writing good poetry, that would forestall the war. There wouldn't be war. It's think about last time you heard someone say something
like
that.
I heard Tunisians and Egyptians say that those regimes fell 2-3 years ago because of the bad music. Mm-hmm. There was mm-hmm. bad art throughout that world. There's bad art in ours, too. I still think there are mm-hmm. artists like Ai Weiwei, for example, in China, that who want to take us into a new sensibility and not just revive Virginia Woolf or James Joyce, but who's out there? Juno Diaz at MIT. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Who are they?
There's W.G. Sebald as well, who died about 10 years ago, whose work I find just truly haunting. When you first read it, it somehow seems a little thin, but it stays with you and haunts you. And there's something in its grayness, you might say, that speaks to our world today. Also, there's this method of that he gets from the film of superimposition, of presenting the present world in all of its detail, and yet somehow through that world seeing or on top of that world really seeing an image of the past, and this sense of a layered reality that comes out of film and a film sensibility, that seems to me a possibility.
Well, all right, I want to just mention Gravity, the movie. Cuarón, Mexican director, there is a huge global ambition in that movie. But I'm also looking for the boldness of Joyce himself. Mm-hmm. That just the phrase, two words, non serviam. I will not serve. This is not working. Right. Father, look out. Mm-hmm. Ireland, look out. Church, look out. Mm-hmm. Empire, Victorian, I'm out of here. We're waiting for somebody to step up to that plate today.
Actually, I was thinking, and then you had mentioned him, Ai Weiwei did actually come to mind as someone who is somewhat similar because he does seem to be willing to fight an oppressive regime so boldly, right? And, Joyce probably was not on the verge of going to jail, though the people who were publishing him were. The women who were publishing him in New York were risking jail time every time they published another obscene portion of Ulysses. But Ai Weiwei is risking his neck. And it's tough to find people who are willing to do that for art. And it is something, you don't want to be nostalgic for it, but it is something we lose when suddenly we're allowed to say and do everything. Right? Is that sense of urgency surrounding art you still find in cultures where art is, to some degree or another, suppressed.
Right. Well, give us a place to look. It's probably going to be a woman who leads us out of this wilderness.
One hopes or suspects. But I just want to continue what Kevin was saying, because I think that, I was starting to think about 2666, Bolyano's book, right. Which, again, we're talking about a response to... a society that has these sort of deep oppressive elements, and it's, as you ask that question, in some ways it's not that I can't think of a number of fantastic writers who are writing impressive, amazing novels, but if you're thinking about this question of breaking a form, of trying to find a new way to express a modern world. And, maybe we have to go to other places in the world.
Let's do it. Let's go boldly. Thank you, Eve Sorum, thank you, Howard Island. Thank you, Kevin Birmingham. It's a fantastic book. Thanks also to the writer and wise man, Vincent Sherry. Next week, we continue the third of three reflections on the Great War, focusing next time on the music that came out of the trenches. We're going out on Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin from 1917, fresh from the composer's wounding time as a truck driver on the Western Front. That's where we start next week. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.